The Apostle Paul never stopped working to fulfill his calling.
He didn't change his theology every time somebody disapproved of it. He didn't negotiate and compromise the truth every time somebody was angered by it. He said, I stayed the course. I remained faithful to my Lord and to his word.
Welcome to Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb, and we're so glad you've joined us on the Sunday edition of our program. For many months now, we have been bringing you a sermon series from Dr. R.C. Sproul in the book of Acts. He's helped us walk through the earliest days of the church, explaining the day of Pentecost, the powerful sermons preached by Peter and the other disciples, the beginnings of persecution in the church with the martyrdom of Stephen. The final chapters of Acts follow the missionary journeys of Paul. Paul faced persecution and violence nearly everywhere he went, but he was undaunted. Today, as we wrap up the series, we'll look at Paul's final days as he faced execution. Here's Dr. Sproul.
First time I went to Rome, I went with a group that I was leading in a tour. And we had professional tour guides of the city. But there was a bonus in that trip, serendipity, something that I didn't expect. When the tour guide took us on our way to the Forum, to one little stop where we went down into what had been originally used as a place to gather water, a cistern carved out of solid rock. And it was a chamber about 15 feet wide and 15 feet deep and about 8 feet high. And this cavern was cold, dark, wet, and dank. I said, what's this? They said, well, this is the Mamertine prison where the Apostle Paul was held captive when he was waiting execution. From the steps of that prison, one can look across the street and see the ruins of the Forum, where the Romans legislated their law and carried out their law. And as a man in prison looks out the window of his cell and can see the scaffold for his hanging being built, so the Apostle Paul awaited his last moments when his head would be placed upon the executioner's block. And I don't know, none of us knows, how long Paul was held prisoner in that cistern. Was it for several months? Was it for several weeks? We don't know. But as I stepped down into that place, all I could imagine was Paul there in that dank, desperate place, writing his final letter to Timothy. It was spooky. It was haunted almost. I mean, to stand there and think, this is where it happened. This is where Paul wrote to his beloved disciple and gave his last words. And he writes to Timothy these poignant words, Timothy, I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. He makes this reference to the Old Testament, to the Old Testament sacrifice system, that when the animals were offered in that sacrifice, they received an oblation, a pouring out of blood on the altar that would accompany the sacrifice. Now, if anybody in history understood that the sacrifice of Christ was a perfect sacrifice offered once for all, and that Paul couldn't possibly add anything of merit or value to that perfect sacrifice of Jesus given once for all, nevertheless, he was acutely aware that it is every Christian's task to bear witness to the perfect sacrifice of Christ by offering to Christ the sacrifice of our own lives. Remember at the end of Romans, after spelling out the doctrines of the gospel, Paul says, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, I beseech you by the mercies of God to present your bodies as a living sacrifice unto him, which is your reasonable service," which is your reasonable act of worship. And so, Timothy, already I'm being poured out as an oblation to honor my Lord. And then he says, "For the time of my departure is at hand." That means it's very, very close. Now, I love the Reformation Study Bible. It's one of my works that I took great joy in helping with. I was responsible to okay every note. And then here in 2 Timothy, when we look at this, where he says about his departure, the particular author here writes this, "Another metaphor for death." Now, if that's all the note would have said, I would have X'd out. But it goes on and says, "Paul held steadfastly to the hope and assurance of a destination beyond the grave." Because Paul does not say, "My death is at hand." He doesn't say to Timothy, "I'm about to perish." He doesn't say, "It's time for me, Timothy, to be killed." I prefer this English translation where it says, "For my departure is at hand." It's interesting, if you go into the sources, the Greek here is somewhat strange because the word that is translated for departure is the word analusis, which we get the English word directly from it, analysis. So a more literal translation may be this, that Paul says, "I'm already being poured out and the time of my analysis is near." But if he wrote that today, somebody would think that he had an appointment with his psychiatrist or with his tax attorney to analyze his financial situation. But rather, the term analysis in English, when it was first coined, was closer to the original meaning in Greek. To analyze something was to parse it, to make close, careful distinctions as you separated one part from another. And what Paul is saying is not that I'm going to die or that my personal existence is going to stop, but in a very short time, my body is going to be separated from my soul. I will still be alive, and in my soul, I will enter into the presence of Christ, though my body will be put into a grave. The Latin source here is the word from which we get the word dissolution, or even better, resolution. So we could translate it this way, that Paul says, "For the time of my resolution is near, at hand." Now again, he's not saying, "I'm about to be killed on New Year's Eve so I can make a resolution." That's not the kind of resolution he's talking about. He's talking about resolving tension, resolving conflict. Those of you who love music know what it's like when the music gets away from the tonic foundation and you begin to experience the tension of dissonance and your ear is crying that the music be resolved. And the great musicians know how to resolve that tension by bringing the melody back home, if you will. And that's what Paul is saying is, my whole life has been a life of stress. My whole life has been a life of tension. Didn't we read that week after week in the chronicle provided for us by Luke, which instead of the Acts of the Apostle could have been reading the tensions and distress of the life of Paul? But he said, that's all done. The time of my resolution is at hand. every problem that I've ever had, every pain I've ever felt will shortly be resolved. So Paul is not writing in a vein where his soul is discouraged or cast down. He's saying, Timothy, I'm ready to go home. I'm already beginning the oblation of the final sacrifice. You see, Paul died a martyr. And again, there's that one little quirk of the English language. The word martyr comes from the Greek word martyria. But the word martyria in Greek does not mean martyr. You know what it means? Witness. And the reason why we get that word martyr in our English is because the early church showed their witness so consistently that often their witness ended in their death. And so the word martyrdom, which originally was synonymous with witnessing, has now come to mean those who witness to the ultimate degree of paying with their lives. And now Paul borrows three metaphors to describe that witness that is about to be resolved. Where he said, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I've kept the faith. I've told you before that of the experience I had as a 17-year-old boy who watched his father die a day at a time. I used to drag him to the dining room table and then back to his bedroom every night. And then one night as I was dragging him, fireman carry, as it were, across the living room floor, he said to me, stop, and put me down for a second on the sofa. And so I let him sit down, and I sat down next to him, and he looked at me, and he said, son, he said, I've fought the good fight. He said, I've finished the race. He said, I've kept the faith. Now, you have to understand, I had never read the Bible. I wasn't a Christian. I had no idea where those words came from. But I knew exactly what my father was saying to me. My father was looking me in the eye and saying, I'm going to die now. Those were his last words he ever spoke to me. My last words to him, to my everlasting shame, were the words, don't say that, Dad. Not realizing what a tremendous testimony of confidence of where he was going my father was giving when he recited those words to me. And so I carried him back to his bed. That night he had his final stroke, went into a coma, never awoke again here. But he was awake there instantly. Can you imagine how I felt later when I became a Christian and was reading the New Testament for the first time and I read those words for the first time? I said, wow. I can't believe it, how rich those words are. The threefold metaphor. First of all, Paul says, I have fought the good fight. Doesn't that rankle you a little bit in terms of the contemporary idea of what Christianity is, that Christians should never be engaged in combat or conflict of any kind? We're supposed to be peacekeepers always, never engaged in arguing or debate and so on. Well, the New Testament tells us we're not to be quarrelsome. We're not to be looking for fights. We're not supposed to be belligerent or bellicose in our personality. But there's a fight out there. There is a good fight. There is a war out there, a spiritual war to which every one of us is called to be engaged in. There is such a thing as a good fight. Every Christian is supposed to believe the things of God. Every Christian is supposed to defend the truths of God. But let me take it one step further. It's not enough to hold the faith or even to defend the faith, but we're called to contend for the faith. Was that not the example of the Apostle Paul that for a year or so we've seen Sunday in and Sunday out? Everywhere he went, He wasn't just preaching Christianity, wasn't just defending it, he was contending for it. Remember one of the most famous lines in the history of Hollywood goes back to On the Waterfront when Marlon Brando says to his brothers, "I could have been a contender." What's it take to be a contender? Anybody can become a professional boxer. Bob Hope tried it in an undistinguished way. But to be a contender, you have to win. And you have to win enough that you become ranked, that you have to be recognized as one of the top 10 fighters in your weight division to even be thought of for a moment as a contender. And then you have to fight your way up that ladder until finally you're able to get a championship bout, a shot at the title. The challenger is not the champion until he defeats the champion, but he is a contender. And Paul was a contender. In fact, Paul was a champion. Apart from Christ, the supreme champion of the kingdom of God in that day. And he said, "I have fought, Timothy, and I have fought." It's interesting the way the language goes. "I have fought the fight." Well, if you fought, you were in a fight, and if you were in a fight, you fought. And so it's almost redundant, but he says, "I have fought the fight," but he wants to say, "I have fought the good fight." There is a good fight, and we are all called to be enlisted in that battle. Now he changes the metaphor from the boxer to the runner, where he said, "I finished the race." Now, the race that Paul's talking about here is not the 100-yard dash. It's easy, in one sense, to be a sprinter, to work like mad for the kingdom over the short haul. But Paul wasn't interested in a 100-yard dash. He was in a marathon. And he was in a marathon that went a lot longer than 26 miles. He went in a marathon that seemed like it would never end. His whole life, he was engaged in that race. Just this morning, I was talking to one of our members about something, and they said to me, "Oh, so you got to be patient." I said, "I know that. I pray for patience all the time. I say, Lord, give me patience right now." And he says, "My grace is sufficient for you." And he says, "You got to take things slowly." I said, "You don't know me very well. I got two speeds, fast and off. There is no such thing as slow." But that's what it takes to be a marathoner, to endure, not to just run for 100 yards. I mean, who would be proud and say to their grandson, "Well, son, once I was in a 100-yard dash, and you should have seen me out of the blocks. I was running like my shoes were on fire. But at the 40-yard mark, I dropped out." Who would be proud of not finishing a 100-yard dash? I mean, that's not very great. But if I came in last in a marathon but finished it, I would be proud to tell that to my grandchildren, to say, "I finished the race." And this is what Paul is saying to Timothy. "Timothy, I didn't just start. I didn't just sprint. But I ran, and I ran, and I ran, and I ran. I was gasping for air, and I kept on running. My legs were burning with fire, but I kept moving for the hope that was in front of me. And now, Timothy, the race is over. I broke the tape. I made it the whole way. And that whole time, Timothy, I've kept the faith." Here the illustration comes from the military. Because even in the ancient world, as well as in the contemporary world, the responsibility of every soldier was fidelity to the general, to his country, duty, honor. Country means fidelity. And when the shooting starts, the faithful soldier doesn't run. He doesn't quit. He goes forward. And that's what Paul says about his life. Like a first century Marine, his motto was Semper Fidelis, always faithful. And not only that sense, but the other nuance is he was also faithful to the doctrine that the Lord gave to him. He didn't change his theology every time somebody disapproved of it. He didn't negotiate and compromise the truth every time somebody was angered by it. He said, I stayed the course. I remained faithful to my Lord and to his word. Could anybody have a better epitaph than that? And so he concludes by saying, finally, there is already laid up for me in the layaway section of heaven. It already has my name on it. The crown of righteousness in the ancient world and the Olympic Games, when the winner was honored in the winner's circle. Nobody came and hung a gold medal around their neck or a silver medal or a bronze medal. Rather, the victor was adorned with the laurel wreath, symbolizing the title crown in his sport. But now he's talking about not the world heavyweight crown or the Olympic crown. He's talking about the crown of righteousness that Christ has put aside, has Paul's name on it. He said, and now I am ready to receive that crown. Which crown of righteousness not only will I receive, but all of you who love his coming will also receive that crown of righteousness. So you see, Timothy, I'm ready to go. And even though he mentions those who betray him in the rest of the closing lines of the letter, he ends with doxology where he thanks God for his mercy and his grace. And his final words to Timothy, grace be with you. How I would have loved to have been a fly in the wall to watch Timothy when he received that parchment of this letter and watch him as he began in chapter 1 and reads through, gets to chapter 3, an exhortation about holding fast to Scripture, and then come to chapter 4 and watch Timothy's tears rolling down his cheek as he sees these words that Paul is about to die. I mean, he had to be weeping when he read these words. And yet at the same time, you could see his chest start to swell. Say, that's my mentor. That's the apostle praying for grace for me and for his people.
What a powerful way to wrap up this series of sermons. Paul's trials were many. Persecution was a constant threat in his life. But he finished without compromise. He accomplished the mission. We're glad you joined us today for Renewing Your Mind. Sadly, we have reached the conclusion of Dr. Sproul's verse-by-verse series through the book of Acts. It's been a joy to hear R.C.'s insight into this book. We're so thankful for his ministry to the congregation at St. Andrew's Chapel. Fortunately, we recorded many of Dr. Sproul's sermon series, so we'll continue sharing them here on the Sunday edition of our program. We know that Paul's emphasis was to proclaim the gospel anytime, any place, and that was Dr. Sproul's emphasis as well. He wrote a booklet that helps us explain the gospel to others. It's titled, What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? We're offering two copies of this booklet, one for you and one for a family member or a friend. You can call us with your gift of any amount and request this offer at 800-435-4343, or you can make your request online at renewingyourmind.org. Let me repeat that contact information. Again, our number is 800-435-4343, our web address, renewingyourmind.org. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we will continue to feature Dr. Sproul's sermons here on our Lord's Day edition of the program. Next week, we'll turn to Paul's letter to the Galatians. This would be the final complete sermon series Dr. Sproul would preach. So we hope you'll join us next Sunday here on Renewing Your Mind.